Welcome to Money Markets and Masterminds, a Citywire South Africa podcast that delves into the intricate world of finance, investment, and strategic decision-making. If you're a fund selector or an independent financial advisor or an institutional capitalist looking for insights, analysis, and expert opinions to enhance your perspective, you're in the right place here with me, editor Ruan Uester. Today, we have Professor Adrian Saville back in studio for our second episode of The Long Game, where we are going to break down economic principles, test political rhetoric against real-world facts, and explore the global economic landscape with clear data-driven insights and compare them all with what US President Donald Trump has to say and plans to do. Welcome back to the show, Adrian.
Great to be with you, Ruan.
Let's start at the beginning. If you study economics at a top university, you should in theory understand the fundamental principles of tariffs, competitiveness, and economic growth. Yet some leaders who claim top-tier education struggle with these basics. One example, Donald Trump, who studied economics at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. So where exactly does Trump fail economics 101?
Well, that's a lovely jump-off point. Trump's economic professor at Wharton made an interesting observation about Trump once he had graduated, and he said, whilst he had no doubt, you know, Trump had a substantial ambition, he questioned his intellectual capabilities, or his, or to that effect. You know, and I had to chuckle there because, you know, as from your intro, I have a professorship in economics. I've taught postgraduate economics for decades. And, you know, economics is a very inexact science. In fact, I'm not even sure if the term science belongs in there. You know, we're working with an incredibly complex system that has lots of moving parts. And to try and establish a source of sort of the single cause and single outcome, you know, root cause analysis, what caused this thing to happen, is always the ambition of economists, but it's seldom the outcome. However, you know, whilst it's not a settled science, we do have lots of evidence. And I'm going to grade Trump on essentially two policy submissions, you know, let's call them economic essay submissions that he's made for our economics class. And the first is the idea that he can protect domestic manufacturing, he can protect domestic industry, he can create jobs by using tariffs. The other way that you do this is you use quotas. But that's the suggestion, that by keeping others out or making it harder for others to participate in our economy, we will do better. It's sort of a them versus us policy. And this is called import substituting industrialization. Whilst it looks very attractive and often has appealed to development economists in the past, it has very, very little evidence that supports it as a policy. The two big development schools that really advocated this in the past were those favoring industrialization through protection in Latin America and Africa. Today, neither Latin America nor Africa really, you know, boasts much by way of grand global manufacturing capability. You don't think of them as export engines. The comparator is Southeast Asia, which used export-oriented industrialization. In other words, they saw the world as their partner. They saw the world as their market. And the super engines of industrialization in the last 30, 40 years, Southeast Asian economies, and by absolute no coincidence, in the previous 30, 40 years, it's Europe, where Europe industrialized to export to the world. So Trump fails his Economics 101 in terms of the tariff proposal. And then the second is he's suggested that you can promote competitiveness by using another form of price manipulation, and that's to make the dollar weak. And he imagines that by making the dollar weak, he'll cause competitiveness in the United States to surge. Why this is just such an abysmal thought is what it fails to recognize is that, okay, some parts of US industry might be able to export more, but what you've done from a global perspective is you've made all US balance sheets and income statements weaker. It's just disastrous economics. I've never given that grade, but I would to Trump.
Another area where poor economic understanding leads to flawed policies is foreign aid. Trump perhaps inadvertently benefits from free grading in the political arena, but the media and political supporters often gloss over the long-term consequences of protectionist policies or trade restrictions, as you said, focusing instead on short-term gains. What are your thoughts on that?
If we were to take just an anecdotal case, one of the saddest stories I can tell you is the story of Malawi, which from the time of independence, I think the year Malawi got independence was 1964. From then to now, Malawi has received more in foreign aid than per capita than their government has spent per capita through central government spending. And look, it's only a sample of one, so let's be careful. You know, but if aid was so successful, you would imagine that Malawi would be a flourishing, thriving society with a strong economy. But of course, that's not what you see. Instead, we find that Malawi has one of the lowest per person incomes globally. It remains an economy that is essentially agriculture-based, no real industry to talk of, other than quasi-agricultural derivatives, sugar, you know, being a case in point. And so aid, in the case of Malawi, quite simply has failed hopelessly. If we look at the evidence globally, if we go away from our anecdote, our sample of one, and look at the broader global evidence, when you assess the impact of foreign aid on country performance, it's about the same as flipping a coin. It really is sort of 50-50 stuff. And I'm not saying that, you know, then that aid doesn't work. You know, what I'm suggesting rather is that it really is a 50-50 outcome. And if we look at the work of, you know, there's people who've done fantastic work in this, Esther Duflo using randomized control trials where you use a, you know, like a pharmacy equivalent. You've got a control and you've got the one that receives the real thing. And based on that, you can figure out if the instrument, i.e. aid, really works. And it leaves economists scratching their heads. It's hard to figure out what causes aid to work in some instances, what causes it to fail in others. But the reality is that aid has not, in the aggregate, changed people's lives. It's changed lives individually. And so what Trump might have done here is by accident rather than by design, he might actually have caused, you know, some good in that he's going to force people to wean themselves off aid. And interestingly, you know, I was in a meeting in Botswana 2 weeks back. I had the fortune of meeting with the Minister of Health, and that was exactly his observation. You know, he said he thinks that the denial of aid may actually eventually force a great awakening. And through that, you get better social policy outcomes.
So, Adrian, with a failing grade in Economics 101, do Trump's policies have the substance to actually make America great again? Or does the data suggest otherwise?
Well, Ron, you know, first, markets are always really good predictors. Not every single time, you know, open and shut case, but oftentimes markets are good predictors. And if we look at the way markets responded to Trump's achievements in his first 50 days, Trump version one, the S&P 500 was up 5% in those first 50 days of Trump. In the current 50 days of Trump, which we've just marked that that anniversary, the S&P 500 is down 7.5%. So, you know, that's a difference between the two presidents of 12.5% or presidencies of 12.5%, which for, you know, an index as representative, as broad, as big as the S&P 500, that is a significant number. And we can't say, you know, therefore convincingly, you know, Trump is a disaster. But if we take this market signal as a sensor of or sensory check of sort of how he's doing, it's a big, big no. And in fact, in his first 50 days, he would rank as one of the worst presidents by an S&P 500 barometer. At the same time, there is a policy uncertainty index that's constructed, and where we find that index printing right now, it's the same as at the time of COVID and global financial crisis. So you've got S&P 500, big thumbs down on Trump. You've got the policy uncertainty index climbing a wall of worry. You've got my academic pedigree saying, you know, he fails economics one. And then you and I have spoken about this before. For a long time, I've been involved in a piece of work that produces the six-factor model. I cheekily call it the Saville six-pack. And this is a piece of work that studies the performance of 160 countries, 60 years of data, and it asks essentially what are the things that matter to country performance, elevated inclusive growth. And when we apply the six-factor model to the US economy, it's difficult to squeeze numbers out that are faster than 2% economic growth. In other words, you know, whilst Trump is talking a fantastic game, the reality is he's got a 2% growth structure. And then, you know, notwithstanding the fact that he's already got a challenging growth structure, he's arrived to the policy party with a baseball bat and he is swinging it wildly with these off the wall pronouncements. And, you know, with Musk's kid in the White House, you know, if that picture doesn't tell 1,000 words, I'm not sure what does.
Let's flip the logic and talk about the six-factor growth model you just mentioned. What do we see in economies that have experienced sustainable, meaningful growth using this six-factor growth model example?
Ron, I mean, that's a great way, I think, to, you know, to frame it so that we can put some substance behind the observation. So there's really, you know, two neat models for thinking about the structure of an economy. The first is called the Solow model, and it relates to the six-factor model. It's named after Robert Solow. Forgive me for being an economic nerd here, but I think this really makes economics so easy. But Robert Solow, he gets the Nobel Prize for economics. He says you know, that the way that you work out the growth structure of an economy is it's essentially population growth times productivity growth. So in today's babies in 20 years' time become part of the workforce. That's your population growth. And if they're increasingly productive, then your population times productivity gives you your growth structure. Now, in the United States, those two numbers are 0.5% and 1.5%. And so, ta-da, there's my magical 2% growth structure for the United States. It's not magic. It's the Solow growth model. Trump hasn't heard of it. Or he's heard of it and he has chosen to ignore it. The other, which also relates to the six-factor growth model. So what the six-factor growth model says is demography is one of the ingredients, i.e. babies. And although it doesn't explicitly reference productivity, it talks about institutions and education. And that's where productivity comes from. So those are two of the six-factor elements. We can go to a third of the six-factor elements, which is savings and investment. And this is picked up in the so-called Harrod-Domar investment model. Now, what they point out is that if you want to grow in line with the world average, you need to invest in line with the world average. I mean, that's like basic economics. The United States is not investing in line with the world average. It is investing less than the world average. They invest 20% of GDP, the world average is 25. And if you invest 20% of GDP, guess what you get if you're the US economy? You get a growth structure of about 2%. So beautifully, you know, the two models marry, and they suggest that, you know, whilst this isn't the sky falling, you know, chicken licking style on our heads, Donald Trump is going to have a very, very hard time given those composites, the absence of babies, modest productivity growth, insufficient investment, and then, you know, he's brought these, what I would call very dangerous policies to the party.
As a last point, let's talk about investment implications. Overvalued currencies can distort trade, and the US dollar's strength has been a recurring theme in global markets. But if you apply purchasing power parity, or just PPP for short, a different picture emerges, doesn't it?
Very different picture emerges. And you know what that PPP model points to, amongst others, is that the most loved economies, I mean, unsurprisingly, a currency gets strong when investors love the country and they allocate money to that country. So it's, I suppose it's self-evident, you know, that a strong currency corresponds with investor enthusiasm. But, you know, in the same breath then, if, you know, if shopping is and finding bargains, attractively priced investments, or great places to holiday is about the bang you get for your buck, then purchasing power parity carries some clues. And if we use that metric to scan the world and look for attractively priced currencies, guess who jumps out? It's not the markets that have been in favor. And the cheapest purchasing power parity currencies, Indonesia, South Africa, Philippines, Vietnam, China, Japan, interestingly, you know, big economy, very sophisticated industry, but exceptionally attractively priced currency. South Korea makes it into the fray. Brazil, Chile. So, you know, that's quite a nice buffet to, you know, to go shopping in. And we can then put the growth structure using that six-factor model on top of the currency structure. And, you know, that then gives you quite a neat cocktail for going and looking. So the Philippines, for instance, not only has an attractively priced currency, it's got a 6% growth structure. If you go shopping in the Filipino peso, if you go shopping in the Vietnamese dong, attractively priced, Vietnam's got a 6% growth structure. Look, South Africa, very attractively priced currency, but we've got a feeble growth structure. So I would, you know, a caution about being far more selective in the case of South Africa rather than sort of wholesale buying the country. You might want to be far more careful. But, you know, others jump out. Indonesia, I made reference to. That's a strong growth structure, attractive currency. And then a couple of commodity currencies. Chile is the one that that stands out.
Adrian, with a minute or two to spare, from all of this, what have we learned or should we learn?
Well, I think that there's three things that are worth putting into the hat very quickly. The first is, you know, whilst Trump has arrived with these disastrous policy ideas, this too shall pass. And, you know, in the fullness of time, Trump will settle down, markets will find their feet, and, you know, we can get on with the ordinary business absent the crazy policies. I think on the way to that, the one thing that we have to worry about is the love affair that is at risk. And that, of course, is Musk plus Trump. So this too shall pass is, you know, my first reminder in thinking about any investment decision. You know, worry about the near-term noise, but focus on the long-term structure. The second is oftentimes when people think about investing, they talk about the country and they forget about the currency that they're making that investment in. So I would just urge a reminder to think about attractively priced countries and then if they can be bought in an attractively priced currency, you've got the double whammy. And then the third is just, you know, a perennial reminder that investing always is about good assets at good prices. And one of the things that really helps assets get into and stay in the strongest shape is the economic growth structure. The US will be okay. Europe might be arriving back at the party. But I would expect over the next 5 years, much of the running in terms of supporting global growth will be picked up by countries that aren't being spoken about. The BRICS Plus members deserve particular mention here.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. And thank you, Adrian, for joining us on the show and helping me and my listeners to compare economic principles against political rhetoric. We will speak to you again in May for another long game discussion. To all our CityWire South African listeners, thank you for tuning into this episode of Money, Markets and Masterminds with me, editor Ruan Uester, and my producer, Vera Loba da Silva from the CityWire Studios team. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a review and share it with your network. We're available on all major platforms such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and iono.fm. All CityWire South Africa's podcasts and videos are also available on our website. Please go register and have a look at our wealth of multimedia content. And with that, and until next time, goodbye.